the more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. We are excited today to talk with renowned English artist Sue Coe, who is famous for her bold graphic style that confronts realities more often overlooked or avoided. One of those realities is the plight of animals in factory farming and other exploitative industries. In her latest book, Zoocide, Sue takes on the institution of zoos, advocating that zoos are inherently cruel and the solution is not to reform them, but to abolish them. Welcome to Voices for the Animals, Sue Coe. Sue, I'm having a little trouble hearing you, so I'm just going to ask our engineer to move up your audio a little bit. So just say hello again.
Hello, Courtney.
There we go. I can hear a trace of that English accent in there. I guess that doesn't leave you, huh?
Well, I'm actually American, but I was born in the UK.
Oh, really? Interesting. Gosh, maybe if I move there, I can get a British accent. That would be cool. So, you know, Sue, let's get started by asking how you got started as an artist and why you chose animals among your other concerns to focus your artistic vision on.
Animals chose me. I grew up next to a slaughterhouse and an intensive hog farm. So on one side, that was two sides. And the only side that had a way out was art. And so I picked art. I was always quite good at it. And I chose that as to be the carrier of the message. For animals quite early on, because animals, non-human animals in my family, and that's, I'm speaking, they can speak for themselves, but I speak to humans through the art. And I found it to be quite effective, whereas, words, I'm using words here, so it's harder, but words are hard to say what I feel. But the work can open up a dialogue. People can look at it and find a way to share their thoughts. So it's not so much what I'm telling people. It's what they're telling me when they see the work. And, you know, I've drawn in a lot of slaughterhouses. I'm very used to it. And, you know, the staff can see what I'm doing. And them seeing themselves through drawing and art helps them to vocalize what they're doing, and they're not listened to. So it's opening up a dialogue that this isn't okay. It's not okay. And, you know, they're just parts cog in the machine. So that was the, you know, origins of all this. And I've kept going at it for years and years and years. And the work's been, I think the work has worked. The work does work. And mainly making vegans.
I think it is working in that it's so, you know, I just know a lot of people know about your work. And so it's obviously you're getting it out there and people are seeing it. Well, and it is very graphic and bold.
It's getting out there because of activists, my second family, because, you know, the art world trivializes women's art. They trivialize animals. So that's double.
Right,
trivialization. So without activism, without activists, you know, I was thinking this is an aside, a small aside. I was thinking about Banksy. You know, he made this work of art that's shredded in an auction house. And I thought, well, if it's women, A, they can't afford a shredder, and B, they don't have to shred their work. They're invisible.
Mm-hmm.
The work disappears as soon as they've made it. So that was just a little aside. But I found my vehicle for communicating, and it works. It can always work better. And so go on, the next question.
I was just going to, mention a little bit more about the slaughterhouse, because as you may know now, you can't really tour slaughterhouses.
Well, you could never tour slaughterhouses. How you get in a slaughterhouse is a relative of a friend of a relative.
Ah.
They're not exactly open for the public, and certainly the kill floor is not accessible because it's dangerous. I mean, it's dangerous
right.
for workers who have safety equipment sometimes. But there's no room for spectators on the kill floor. You're dealing with bodies coming down, at least swaying down from the ceiling of persons who are hanging upside down and still alive, and they're kicking. So, you could be stood there with your sketchbook, and you can only stand in one specific place. So it's always been very hard.
But so you went into a slaughterhouse and sketched from inside the slaughterhouse?
Well, I've been into many, many slaughterhouses
and
sketch. But, I mean, what they can see is what I'm doing. So they'll say, oh, are you an animal rights activist? And I say, I'm English.
That answers it. or
right.
evades and it. Then, one of those two.
And then why do you want to draw this? And I'll say Rembrandt, and they'll say, who's Rembrandt? And then I'll show them Rembrandt's slaughtered ox.
Ah, that's handy. You carry that with you at all times, I guess, huh?
I do. I've got a postcard with it all times. But that's, in case I can get in. But it's more about, I'm transparent about what I'm doing. So they can see the drawings, and they can tell me, is this not accurate? If it's not accurate, then I'll redo it. What's not accurate about this sketch?
Mm.
So that gives the humans a level of control. Otherwise, it's just you're perceived as the enemy, obviously. You're perceived as, government agent or something. In any situation, whether it's a prison or anything that's concealed, there's no transparency. That's the nature of it. And being an artist, there's no camera. To get into a slaughterhouse, as I'm saying, you take off your clothes. You're put in their clothes.
Hmm.
So, unless you're doing hidden video as a, undercover, it would be impossible. So you've got a sketchbook. You take off your clothes, your hair's covered, your body's covered, you've got special boots, you've got, all levels of security. So, anyway, that's not really interesting. What's interesting is finding out what you can't do and then figuring out how can we do this. Like, we're animal rights, animal liberation activists. What's the best strategy? What can we do? And those strategies change from day to day. It's not
right.
One permanent strategy. Oh, this is going to work. It might work that hour, and then it might not work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what else? What else?
Okay, well, let's move on from slaughterhouses to zoos, because your latest book is called Zoocide. And I'm not quite coming up with the second part of that right now. I forgot to write that part down. But anyway, it's really, the title kind of says it all. But I wanted you to just explain to us how you came to write the book, what influenced you, and also talk a little bit about the essay that's included in the book.
Well, I didn't write the book. Stephen wrote the book.
Right.
The last book I did
You did the drawings, right?
The Animals Vegan Manifesto, which was a book without words, which was so brilliant for me. I don't know why I never thought of this before, because I hate writing. So he's done the text, which is absolutely magnificent, even though it's really great text. And I did the drawings. And the difference between this book and the other drawing slaughterhouses is drawing slaughterhouses, you're exposing what's hidden. With zoos, you're exposing what's in full view. And that was interesting. That was very interesting because more people go to zoos and aquaria than any major sports event in America.
Hmm.
So that is facts, 180 million visits a year.
Wow.
That's more than any sports event. So it's massive. And as we're analyzing this through a neoliberal capitalism lens, there's only two analyses. One is Marxist, the other is capitalism. So we're analyzing this in a Marxist way, just to be a little bit different. And so this is a neoliberal current that's current. It's not industrial capitalist zoo. It's not pre-capitalist menagerie. It's neoliberal zoo, which is created by investors or patrons and stocked with animals, increasing in value, natural-looking habitats, didactics, research, marketing, corporate sponsorships, big one there, and breeding, further enhancing its value. The purpose of the zoo is to increase zoo revenue and create investor, patron, and corporate wealth. Now, the way, if you ask any American, anyone, what are zoos for? What do you think they're for? They'll say, animals are going extinct and they're protecting animals from going extinct. Conservation. Now, the facts are these. Only 1% of the profit revenue of the budget, 1% goes into conservation. 1%.
Yeah.
Only.
I don't think most people even know that, do you?
No. This is like eating meat. It's protein. Where does capitalism get its protein? Right? So that was interesting. The second point I was going to say about zoos is that, you know, if you take all the zoos in the world and aquaria, only 3% have any form of enrichment or veterinary care. 3%.
I assume those are the AZA accredited facilities?
That's the AZA accredited. And that is who the president that... From her, she gave that statement. Only 3% have any sort of welfare, and I use that word very with great disgust, because we know where that leads.
Right, right. What they consider welfare is fairly wide in scope. I mean, giving them a toy is welfare.
Yeah, and it's the welfare is for the human perception only. It's about marketing. You know, it's got nothing to do with anything much. I mean, yes, 1 inch more cage space does matter to that individual hen. But if it's used to continue promoting animal exploitation, is that a good strategy, do you think, in terms of animal liberation? Mm-hmm. No, of course not. So that brings us to abolition, neatly into abolition, which is abolition of all use.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, what I find works. That's just, if I'm talking to people that consume animal products, I find that approach, the abolitionist approach, they get it. The others are very confusing.
I see. Very confusing. So you're saying that, you know, the whole concept of why you arrived at, you know, getting rid of them instead of just reforming them is it actually helps to clarify the discussion.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay.
No,
I hadn't thought of it that way, so thank you for clarifying that for me. I think we're just about ready to take a very short break, and we'll be right back. We're going to be continuing on with our discussion with Sue Coe, graphic artist and extraordinary animal rights activist as well. And we'll be right back right after this short break. So welcome back to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland with our special guest, artist Sue Coe, who is discussing her new book, Zoocide. Sue, go ahead and give us the whole title of that book. We might as well get that out.
Okay. It says, Zoocide, Seeing Cruelty, Demanding Abolition. So it's not seeing cruelty demanding minute welfare changes. So 5% of imprisoned animals can get some enrichment by the year 2050. No, it's abolition. That means all you 187 million dedicated zoo customers have to stop doing it. Don't do it. Don't go. Don't give them your money. There's many other places that could benefit from your money.
Right. And I don't know if you've seen, there's a Chinese zoo, I think that's...
Seen it.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
Well, it's 60 years old and it has animals in prison there.
Oh.
60 years old. Yeah, I'm sorry to tell you that.
Oh, dear. So it's not true about their virtual reality then?
Oh, it is true. And it's very, very interesting because they do a lot of education, and it's serious education. You go to an American zoo, and it says, you know, brought to you by Pepsi-Cola, Citibank Corporation, little plaque. And then it says underneath, and these animals are threatened by human breeding or something silly. And then they sell animal bodies next door, you know, in the concession.
Oh, right. Yeah, I know.
Right.
Yeah. Burgers.
But this virtual zoo, which is the first of its kind, virtual reality zoo, is, and it's all different types of technology, is much more educational, and they've got it because it's focused on entertaining the kids, children, without using animals as props, living animals as props. The zoo is 60 years old. I think they are phasing out the living animals, and they have they seem to be onto something, and I thought it was very, very interesting. And you know, the dinosaurs, it's just you can walk in with the dinosaurs and they know their zoo audience is, does it look good as a selfie on Instagram? They've got that perfectly, where you've got a computer-generated animal. You are in with that generated animal, and you're taking a selfie. So they've looked at this. They know. And I think it's very positive.
Yeah, it reminds me, at our zoo, they had a robotic dinosaur one year, and the kids just climbed all over that.
Yeah. And that's also what leads to these tragedies for animals, is so many of the prisons look like climbing frames. So they'll have half the zoo is all, you know, playground for children. And then where the animals are imprisoned, the children don't know. They just start playing on the bars and fall in. So it's a boondoggle from top to bottom.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went to, did a lot of drawing in Bronx Zoo, which has a plane going over low every 18 seconds.
Wow.
And where the food in... is all animal bodies a few feet away from the living animals. So in the wild bird section, they have a fried chicken stand.
Oh,
so the
God.
Birds can smell themselves being burned.
That's interesting. I don't think many people even think about those things.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I want on our tombstones. I want this statement. Why aren't they seeing this? ?
Because
I don't know why they're not seeing this. So, yes, I have to be graphic and heavy-handed to show people, why aren't you seeing this?
Yeah. It's almost sometimes you wonder if there's an empathy gene missing.
I did that book. That was a good letter. I did the empathy gene missing.
Yeah. I think that's a lot to do with it. So one of the disturbing things you illustrate in Zoocide is the fact that animals do sometimes commit suicide. So do you have any examples of that you wanted to share?
Well, I think it's more about non-suicidal self-injury is more common.
You
see, this stereotypical behavior and vomiting on, you know, a primate vomiting onto their arm over and over again and eating the vomit. That's very common. Or pacing, head bobbing, weaving lead to death eventually. And then, you know, the one that just is so poignant is Senja and Snowflake, the two polar bears at SeaWorld. SeaWorld. So they were best friends for 20 years. They were always together. And then they took Snowflake, sexually molested her to breed her, which that could be a whole nother book in itself. But And Snowflake took 2 months to starve herself to death.
Oh, you know, I didn't even know they had polar bears at SeaWorld. Mm-hmm. I've never been to SeaWorld, so I didn't know. I thought it was mostly marine mammals.
No. So, you know, I just thought, well, I'm not going to go to SeaWorld. I draw the line at my research. I'm not paying them money to go to SeaWorld.
Yeah,
that was through, I researched that, and it's just terrible because people begged SeaWorld, don't separate them. They've been together their entire lives, don't separate them.
Yeah, that's so sad. And to think they didn't even notice over those 2 months.
They noticed something was wrong. She refused to eat.
But they didn't connect the dots.
Well, no, because, you know, they're the worst. you know, they always accuse us of anthropomorphizing animals.
I know.
And yet, somehow they feel they know better.
Right.
And it's beyond belief what happens. It's beyond belief. And all we can do is just boycott. And I hate this idea of consumer choice. I hate it. You know, but that's all we have in this political system.
Now, what do you mean, consumer choice, boycotting? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, rather than having political action, in which case consuming animals would be illegal by now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of climate.
I know. You would think they would make those connections.
You would think.
I know.
So, but we have no working government. The government only works for corporations.
Right. Yeah.
And it's so all we have, we can control what we eat. That's it. We can control who we give money to.
Right.
And it's pathetic. I mean, I just that just hate consumer choice because it leads into a whole lot of other issues about, you know, we're talking about abolition and animals being chattel property. You know, it's this analysis by Gary Francione that just, you know, I was in the animal confusion movement, and then I read his work, and I thought, oh, this is too extreme. This was years ago. And I thought, oh, no, he's right.
Yeah.
You know, as long as animals are considered property, there's absolutely nothing that will ever change.
Exactly. Well, of course, and you know that's what Stephen Wise is working on with the Non-Human Rights Project.
Yeah.
Which is, as he knows, it's a long-term project. But at least it started.
Yeah. I was just going to say that my friend lives in Portland, who's this genius animal lawyer. I mean, and he explains a lot of things to me I'm ignorant about
who is
the law.
It?
He works in Portland.
Do you know his name? Can you reveal that?
I know his name. He's called Peter Brandt.
Peter Brandt. We're writing it down right now.
Yeah, you should have him on because
okay.
You know, every time I start complaining and complaining about the law, he gives such a brilliant analysis of why this law could be useful with this. And he's just, I mean, it's just, you know, what Karl Marx said is that pre-capitalism, knowledge, the arts, poets, doctors, scientists, astronomers, had a halo around them of respect. Post-capitalism, we're just cogs, were units to create profit.
To create Pepsi commercials.
Yeah. So the halo effect.
You could probably make a lot of money doing that, Sue.
I can't make money at anything, trust me. Anyway, the halo effect is how we once perceived animals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with awe and wonder. That's how we saw nature. And how I perceive now animals, I perceive them that way, but I perceive lawyers who are animal rights activists. I perceive them that way. and I see great art and science, and I think that is just brilliant. It's not about money. It's not about profit. It's about accumulated knowledge to benefit everyone. And so the halo is still intact, even within neoliberal capitalism.
Well, that's a sign of hope.
Well, we have to invent hope.
Right.
Just try and invent.
You have to be creative about that hope.
Yeah, you do.
So I just wanted to mention that, you know, it's interesting that the Ringling Brothers closed down, and people seem to get it now about circuses, at least a lot more than they used to.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering, why do you think, I have my opinion about zoos. They seem like they're just like some kind of mom and pop or mom and apple pie that everybody thinks is so wonderful. And it seems to be stuck in the brain like some kind of disease that we can't get rid of. What do you think about that? Why do you think zoos are still so popular, whereas circuses are not?
Because it's a safe space for women. They can walk around all day, and they're with their spawn. They're with their human spawn in baby carriages. It's a safe space for them.
You know what? I just have to add that it's not a safe space for me. When I go there and all those strollers are there, I'm scared to death of being run over.
Yeah. That goes with it.
It's totally frightening. But anyway, Sue, we're coming up on the end of the show, but I wanted to just say and ask, do you have anything coming up in the future you want to share with our audience? Possibly a book tour here in Portland or anything else?
I'd love to come to Portland. I will come just to stay with Peter Brandt.
All right. Well, you let us know, because we'll definitely invite you back on to talk to us again, because we've really enjoyed having you today.
Oh, I bet you say that to everybody.
Not with such enthusiasm. Right, Deb? She's okay, we're coming
you.
Up at the end. So anyway, anything else you want to add before we end our show today, Sue?
Well, I need ideas for my next book, because it's like everything not dealing with climate change is like talking about the common cold. And yet I just don't know how to tackle this. I don't know.
So well, you tackled the Me Too thing. That was a brilliant depiction of the elephant and the Me Too thing. I forgot to mention that during our interview here.
You.
We have it posted, though, listening audience, on our website. So you can see Sue's really brilliant drawing. Which she translates the Me Too movement to the animal kingdom. And so, Sue, thank you so much for joining us on Voices for the Animals today.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. And we just want to mention that Sue's new book, Zoocide, is a timely tie-in to a campaign this month for a local nonprofit, Free the Oregon Zoo Elephants, sponsored by Care2. Join a rally for the elephants at the Oregon Zoo on October 27th from noon to 2 p.m. Find out more on the FOES Facebook page. We will include a link to that and to Sue Coe's work on our KABU website. You can listen to a podcast of this episode of Voices for the Animals on KBOO.FM. And hear us again live the fourth Monday of the month.